Welcome, everybody. Senate Education Policy Committee is called to order. We have a quorum present. We have four bills today. I just want to remind members, and I'll say this again at the end of the meeting, but Wednesday, we're postponing, rescheduling our hearing, and we will be doing that. And Senator Coleman, the lead on the committee, and myself are planning on attending the memorial service. So anyways, for the fallen officers. So with that said, and others are joining as well. Senator Hochschild, please move your bill, and we'll have it referred, or no, not yet, sorry. We'll get to that. Senator Hochschild, you're up.
All right. Thank you, Chair Swadzinski, members of the Education Policy Committee, for hearing my proposal, Senate File 3790, the Great Start Child Care Affordability Bill for Minnesota families. My district is the largest and most rural district in Minnesota. It stretches from Hermantown to the Grand Portage Tribal Band in the northeasternmost tip of Minnesota, across half the Canadian border and into Couchiching County and Itasca County, as well as the East Iron Range. That's why when I think about the challenges that we face as a state, I try to think about them through the lens of how they impact our smallest and most rural communities. I can say without a doubt that one of the top issues I hear about in our rural communities is available and affordable childcare. In fact, I've hosted three childcare roundtables throughout northeastern Minnesota, and I continue to be astounded by the number of families that approach me about the issue of childcare affordability. In many of the communities in greater Minnesota, childcare quite literally does not exist. And when it does, the loan provider is just trying to make ends meet. This in turn makes the cost of running a childcare center that much more expensive for the providers and for the families in our most rural towns. I was recently in Ely talking to a father who is in a leadership position in a business there in town. He has to work as early as 4 a.m. and late in the evenings after his kids go to bed on a flexible schedule, given the fact that he does not have childcare available in his community. The truth is, our childcare system is a market failure, especially for our rural communities. The economics simply do not work. We can't pay the childcare providers enough to make a living wage, despite the fact that our families are paying oftentimes more than their mortgages for the childcare that they need. But it's not just our young families that are suffering. I hear time and again about businesses that would like to open up in the Northland and on the Iron Range, but they can't because of the workforce challenges that we face as it relates to childcare for families that want to settle in our region. This in turn creates a cycle by which more and more young people move away from their hometowns to the Twin Cities or other metropolitan areas where jobs, childcare, and housing are more abundant. We can't leave greater Minnesota behind. While I've heard about this issue time and again, I also know the experience firsthand. More important than my work as a senator is my work and my job as a father of a three-year-old son, Henry, and my baby daughter, Isla. My wife works in the front line of healthcare in a hospital and often has to be on call. We quite literally couldn't do the job of serving in public service and serving on the front lines of healthcare if it wasn't for the childcare that's provided to us by the YMCA in Hermantown. My family relies on childcare providers, and we're grateful for that care. In fact, my wife was recently in Target. This is just an anecdote. My wife was recently in Target with our son and daughter, and somebody said, "Henry, Henry," to my son. And she turns around, and it was one of the childcare providers talking about how she was currently working one of her three jobs to make ends meet. And she recognized our son because she cares for him throughout the day. That just simply shouldn't be the case. More and more young people are delaying starting a family because of the cost. This in turn impacts the long-term workforce challenges, the growth of our economy, and the vitality of our communities. This last session was a big one in supporting our lowest income families and providing stabilization for our childcare providers. However, we have to do more for middle-class families and working families that are just trying to get by. Our goal with this bill is to ensure that no family pays more than the recommended 7% of their income on childcare. Our legislation would help reduce the cost of childcare for families making up to 150% of the state's median income. As one example, in my home county, St. Louis County, an average family of four would save an estimated $5,400 in childcare costs. Before I end my remarks, I just want to say that some folks may ask, why should we provide childcare relief for young families? That doesn't support all Minnesotans. It doesn't support the seniors and some of the middle-aged Minnesotans who maybe no longer have kids in childcare. But the answer is simple of why we would do this. In Minnesota, we go out of our way to help those that need it most because we know that life is that much easier when we have each other's back. This last session, for example, we provided seniors with $1.2 billion in Social Security tax relief and $300 million for our nursing homes when they needed it to stay open. Now is the time that we support our young families that need our help in order to prosper, because we all want vibrant, growing communities. For a strengthened workforce and for our future, I hope you'll join me in supporting this bill. Thank you. And I'm open to any questions you have, or we can bring up testifiers.
Yeah,
Mr.
let's
Chair.
Do, we'll bring up testifiers first. And so, Erica Moss, Courtney Greiner, and Jess Rhodes are the first three. Begin.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Erica Moss, and I work for Think Small. We refer to ourselves proudly as leaders in early learning, and our work covers multiple facets, including administering early learning scholarships and the parent aware ratings in the metro area. I'm here today speaking in support of Senate File 3790, which we view as critically important to our highest strategic priority, all children ready for kindergarten. Specifically, we regularly see families narrowly miss eligibility for early learning scholarships. One parent, Daniel Rogge, wrote about his experience in the Star Tribune saying, "A few thousand dollars. That is what stands between my younger son having the early education he deserves and quality childcare, and me having enough money in my budget to make ends meet." He goes on to say that it isn't right that Minnesota has a system that only helps people once they reach poverty, but won't help them stay out of poverty. Simply put, all children cannot be ready for kindergarten if the burden for financing their early education falls on parents too cash-strapped to pay for the opportunity. Senate File 3790 addresses the current funding cliff and brings much-needed help. Specifically, the proposal builds on the successful Early Learning Scholarship Program, including by giving parents flexibility to choose the program type that best meets their needs. It also builds on the Great Start Task Force recommendations, which offer a blueprint for creating a system that works for parents, kids, and the early childhood workforce. Most notably, the bill includes a key policy change from existing programs by setting the income limit for eligibility at 150% of state median income, or about $174,000 for a family of four. The current eligibility is about $55,000 a year for a family of four. This eligibility limit would mean that about 86% of families with young children would be eligible to benefit, with the largest amounts going to families right on the other side of the cliff that I mentioned earlier. Currently, only the bottom third of families are eligible for help. Another key policy change from existing programs would have the state paying providers prospectively in advance of service each month and paying based on enrollment rather than attendance, just as private pay families do now. This aspect of the proposal borrows best practice from our neighbor, North Dakota, and is aimed squarely at strengthening and stabilizing our home and center-based programs, which continue to struggle post-COVID. Think Small cares deeply about the quality of our early care and education programs, and we know that we cannot build quality on shaky foundations. We are excited about this proposal and look forward to partnering with the authors to help get families help as soon as possible. I'm available for questions as needed. Thank you.
Ms. Greiner.
Good afternoon, Chair Zawinski and members of the committee. My name is Courtney Greiner. I'm the proud owner of Esco Minis Childcare in Esco, Minnesota, where our most important core value is kids are at the heart. Every child and family in Minnesota deserves access to high quality, affordable childcare and early learning, especially at the time of their lives when their young brains are developing at an exponential rate. I'm here today to implore the state of Minnesota to take the significant burden of childcare costs off the shoulders of young families and providers by passing SF3790. Over 7 years ago, as a family childcare provider, I saw the high need for more affordable care in our area. After 7 years of pouring our own personal savings into ESCO minis, I understand why. Childcare is an unsustainable business model. We cannot charge the amount we truly need to have a high-quality program because families can't afford to pay that much. Instead, we charge families the least amount we can to still stay open, which is still a huge stretch for families, forcing too many to decide between working and paying for childcare. It's also nowhere near enough to pay our teachers what they deserve or for us to make a profit. While SF3790 reduces childcare costs for families, it will also have a positive impact for providers. Many of our amazing staff are young moms who cannot work for us unless we provide discounted childcare for their children. It's simple math. They make $35,000 a year, and care at our center for two children costs them $27,000. That leaves $8,000 a year for all necessary expenses. Our own teachers can't afford childcare at our center. This discounted childcare costs us, as a business, over $250,000 a year, oftentimes supported by my family's own personal savings. We also give thousands of dollars in scholarships every year to families struggling to cover childcare costs. This bill will take the burden off of our already challenging costs of running this business. It may not seem like much, but the fact that this bill requires payments to be made to providers prospectively is hugely impactful. It will give us the resources we need when we need them, not months later. Kids are at the heart of our decisions. Put them at the heart of the state of Minnesota's decisions as well. We can do this by passing this bill, putting the care, education, and growth of young children on the same level as K through 12. Support parents so they can participate in the workforce. Support the teachers that are doing this amazing work. Support the providers that will continue to put the kids at the heart and give families the chance to be families. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next testifier is on Zoom, Ms. Rhodes.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Jess Rhodes, and I'm here today with Minnesota Parents for Child Care Affordability. I have a higher salary than multiple generations of my children or my family could have dreamed of. I have two degrees when neither my mother or her mother graduated high school. I don't say that because I think I'm better than them or any other people who had a similar situation, but to help you understand where I'm coming from. I did all the things I was told would lead me and my children to a bright, financially stable future. I got good grades in school, I worked multiple jobs through my teens and 20s, and I scrambled my way to get here, all so I could plan a family and offer them more than I had. But yet, I'm paycheck to paycheck, draining my savings and struggling to keep up ever since my first child started daycare last year. We pay $25,000 per year for one child in a daycare center, which is more than our mortgage. We'll double that amount in 2025 now that I have another baby on the way. We love our daycare center, knowing that our child is safe and learning new things every day from qualified education providers. My busy 16-month-old comes home using new signs and shows us the songs she's learned. Her teachers send us photos every day of her favorite activity, which is handing them books over and over. I don't want to lose this opportunity for her or for my second child, but I can't shoulder a $50,000 annual payment alone on top of everything else. Even now, more than just the experience of having no savings for medical care or even extra funds for clothing, I can't save for a college education for either of them. I can't even pay for a life insurance plan to make sure that they're taken care of if I die, or my own retirement. Simply put, I can't afford to both keep my career and have my children. Please help parents like me break our generational barriers and provide quality early education and a future to our children. No one should have to struggle the way that we already have. We don't want to be rich and own million-dollar houses. We just want our kids to thrive. Thank you.
Thank you. Nakia Howard, Mariah Farah, and Shamark Hussein. Just a reminder to testifiers to sign in the booklet. Sometimes we forget. Clipboard today. Thank you, Senator. Okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Nakia Howard. I am a 4-star Parent Aware rated licensed family child care provider from Oakdale. I am here today in support of the SF 3790, because I do not feel it is right for the opportunity of an early education to be so dependent on what a child's family can afford. I know I said I was a child care provider, but make no mistake, when it comes to our babies, toddlers, and preschoolers, both caring and educating are happening nonstop. I provide both. As a small home-based provider, I know every single parent in my program. I see them every day at drop-off and pickup. I see that they are tired, I see their stress, and I hear about their struggles. I know how hard those without any assistance are working to afford my program. I try to help where I can, but I can only make so many sacrifices before I jeopardize my business. Last year, I celebrated the increased funding for child care assistance and the early learning scholarships. At that time, I know that there are many families who don't qualify for those programs, but still need my help. I thank Senator Hochschild for listening to those families and bringing this bill forward, and I look forward to partnering with him to make this program a success.
Thank you. Ms. Farah, thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Swazinski and members of the committee. My name is Marin Farah, and I'm a parent of 2 children in childcare and a leader with Kids Count on Us. Thank you for the opportunity to share my story. I have a 4-year-old and an 11-month-old. I work full-time at a school in administration, and my background is human resources. I have a husband in medical school currently. He does his clinicals in Chicago, which means he is unfortunately only home on the weekends. So my Mondays through Fridays are pretty hectic, especially without my husband. I wake up early to get my preschooler ready. Then I get myself ready while the baby's asleep. And when we're both ready, I wake up the baby. While I drop off my preschooler at childcare, my baby then goes to a family child care provider. I'm the sole provider for my family. I'm currently able to work because we receive child care assistance. We qualified for assistance because I was in between jobs and I was looking for some work when I had my second child. Now I am a full-time worker. My salary is higher than the income limit to qualify for child assistance, which is $59,000. When our assistance is redetermined next year, if my salary does not exceed $84,000, we will continue to receive assistance. This leaves us in a weird bubble where my career goals are kind of on hold. You know, if I make too much money, we won't be able to qualify for assistance. And if we don't qualify for assistance, then we can't afford childcare because our childcare costs would be twice as much as our mortgage. And if we don't have childcare, that means I can't work. So SF 3790 would have a life-changing impact for my family and thousands of other Minnesotans. Right now, our budget is so tight that extracurricular activities, even as simple as like swimming lessons, are out of the question. Regular family outings that cost any money out of, sort of type of money is out of question. Moving into A job where I make more than $85,000 is out of the question, which feels completely and entirely wrong. Parents want to provide for their families, but it is impossible for parents of young children to shoulder the burden of paying for childcare on their own, and I urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Swazinski and members of the committee. My name is Shamarki Hussein, and I am a parent and Take Action Minnesota leader. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to share our stories. The high cost of childcare has really put my back against the wall. It's been really tough, and I know how important the early years are for kids. And like any parent, I've made sacrifices, but it's just never enough. It's either work long hours to be able to afford childcare and miss out on those precious hours with them, or take time off work and I know I can't provide the type of life I want to. It's not just me feeling this pinch. I've gone door to door with Take Action Minnesota and connected with other parents about this. No matter where we're door knocking, it is just so easy to connect with parents about our childcare struggles. We have yet to meet parents who are not struggling to figure out how to make childcare work for their family. Making childcare cheaper for working families would be a game changer. It means we wouldn't have to worry so much about where our kids are during the day and if they're okay. It means we could go to work feeling a bit more peace of mind knowing our kids are in a good place. Our children are the future, and our government needs to see the value in investing in our future. Money spent improving access to children to childcare isn't a cost, it's an investment. It's money back in the pockets of parents, it's money spent on clothes for kids who seem to outgrow them every week, it's money spent on toys, on books, it's money that goes right back into the economy. But it also means more time spent laughing with our kids, more time forming beautiful memories of that precious age we all love so much. It means better lives for the kids of Minnesota. Please pass this bill for parents and children around Minnesota.
Thank you. Thank you, testifiers. Members, any questions? Senator Duckworth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. Just one question and then a couple of comments. Senator Hochschild, thank you very much for bringing the bill forward and highlighting the issue. I'm curious, I know it, obviously at this stage sometimes bills have blanks in them in terms of estimated cost. I'm just curious what you've heard in terms of what the estimated cost impact would be of a bill like this, just so that we have an idea of what we're talking about.
Chair Swadzinski, Senator Duckworth, thanks for the question. It's an important one. The great thing about this program is that it's scalable. So certainly what we've described is that our goal would be to reach 150% of median income to try to reach that recommended Department of Health and Human Service recommendation for 7% of income, which would be about, let me make sure I've got the amount right, I believe it's $173,000 a year for a family of income. In order to reach that, we'd be talking a substantial amount of money, which is why it's blank. We'll see what the forecast says. We'll see what the appetite is for possibly moving this bill forward. But, you know, the great thing about it is that if we're given an allocation of money, we can sort of scale this program to make an impact for the families that need it.
If I may, Mr. Chair. Thank you, and I can appreciate that answer. And I think you hit the nail on the head when you referenced the forecast, right? Knowing what the financial situation of the state's going to be and what a financial estimate of what something like this would cost, I think is going to be important. Because everything you said and everything that the testifiers said is completely valid, and it's only getting worse. I've got three little kids. I'm the oldest of four boys, and my mom had an in-home daycare because that was probably the only way that she could afford to make sure that her four boys were cared for during the day. Then as we got older, we transitioned to my grandma's in-home daycare. And so I appreciate the conversation that's taken place. I think we need to look at this through multiple different perspectives, whether it's a grant or whether it's giving tax credits to folks who are spending absorbing amounts of money on childcare. And also from a regulation standpoint, how can we make it more affordable to run childcare centers and employ folks, things of that nature. So I appreciate the discussion that this bill is generating, and I would encourage you, and happy to work with you on it, to look at an all-encompassing approach to making childcare much more affordable and accessible for folks in general. So thank you.
Senator McQuaid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Hauschild, if there's one, the only thing I'm disappointed about in this bill is that I'm not the chief author. It's the only thing I'm disappointed. I am so, so grateful for your work on this and for the work that you've done in your own community and across the state to garner support, to have this conversation, and to really bring the conversation forward. I want to encourage you to not look at tax credits, and I want to tell you a little bit about why. My wife and I, we have a 22-month-old. I think our daughters are almost the same age. And we spend $24,000 a year in early learning costs because it's not just childcare. They're not just popping her into a room and, you know, sending us a few pictures while she, like, runs in the corner. Like, she was naming letters yesterday. She was going B, A. She's learning things in school. I mean, that's what she's going to. And no matter if it's in-home or center-based, it is early learning opportunities. And I think we are just one of the only countries in the world that don't treat children as a public good. They are a public good. And that is why we have to take this kind of approach to say, parents aren't on their own, that we are all in this together. We all have a collective investment in the strong early start for all young people in Minnesota, all the children in Minnesota, so that they can have the best future. But if they don't have those foundational years and their parents don't have that affordable, high-quality early learning opportunity, then they're just not getting off to that great start. So thank you for doing all this work, because when you start a big bill like this, and I'm sure Senator Mann can talk about this with paid family medical leave, it becomes a whole thing unto itself. And so this is just incredible to see come before us. The one thing that I did want to ask you is, you talked a little bit about getting us to no more than 7%. So this is like a really good first start. Do you know the percentage of Minnesotans that would kind of fall into that about no more than 7%?
Chair Swadzinski, Senator McQuaid, when you say who would fall within the 7%, you're saying who would qualify for this program to get to that 7% and then fall off once their income automatically is 7% of their income on childcare?
Or what percentage of Minnesota parents might fit into this bucket?
That's a good question. I might refer to my expert here.
And identify yourself for the record.
Sure. Chair and committee members, Erica Moss again from Think Small. Senator McQuaid, this proposal would cover 86% of families with children under five. So that is the that is kind of it helps you visualize maybe where families fall in the income spectrum when they have young children. The vast majority of families with young children are between about $60,000 a year and $100,000 a year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that's really helpful. I mean, I can't imagine a more startling number to know that this kind of investment would help 85-86% of families. I'll just end by saying, you know, before I had a child, I understood the immense costs of early learning programming, but the reason why I'm going to encourage you not to go for tax credits is because this cost is bared month to month. This is a paycheck to paycheck, month to month thing. People who can afford to wait for the tax credit are not the people we're talking about here today. And so I really want to encourage you to stick with this, because this is what's going to help Minnesota families. I want us to do what's actually going to work and not the stuff that already helps people who are doing just fine. So thank you for your work, Senator Hauschild.
Senator Kunesh.
Thank you, Senator Hauschild. You know, I look at this from so many different perspectives. First of all, I myself was a family daycare provider for 5 years, and I know the kind of how much those families depend on a daycare provider and the ability to go do the work that they need to do and know that their kids are going to be taken care of in a good way. It was really great for my own children as well. And honest to God, those families actually paid for my college degree. So I am deeply indebted to them. And now I have two young granddaughters that I help with the child care. One day they go to one grandparents, another day they come to my house on Fridays. Many of you have seen them on Zooms. And then they go to a family daycare in between. And I see the difference just having those 2 days makes in both of their lives and their incomes. Grandparents are picking up a lot of the extra work that is going to be needed for our child daycare program. But I think what I think is most interesting to me, or that I like best about your proposal, are those direct payments to the caregiver. And just as Senator McQuaid said, any kind of a tax break or a refund doesn't help those families in that moment. If those direct payments went to the caregiver, those caregivers would know that that income is going to be stable. What happens if a parent loses their job and they come to you and say, I can't come next week? Now you're going to have to find another place for that. But you've got the direct payment to the caregiver, and I think that's really important to the caregiver, but it also takes one more burden off of the families as well, knowing that that's going to come in. I know that there have been lots of numbers thrown around at the cost of this. I think this is definitely worth the discussion and the investigation and working towards a program such as this as we look forward. I mean, this is our second year, all of us together here, working for a future, and I think this really definitely needs to be part of that future. And so as we go forward and discussing it and making sure that we're keeping this in mind as we make plans for our children's future, for your children's future, and the generations to come in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Bolden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Hochschild, for bringing this bill. I am thrilled that we are hearing this bill today, and I'm really grateful for all of the work that you have been doing around this space and having all the conversations that you have been having and really elevating this issue. You know, I think as legislators, as I see part of our role, is to really respond to the needs in our communities. And I will say, as I talk to people in my district, as I imagine is the same for all of us, this issue rises to one of the top issues that I hear about. It is, you know, I cannot talk to a family with young kids without this coming to the fore. It is a challenge for so many families. And rightfully so, we've been talking about the cost of this, because there is a cost, certainly. But I would challenge us to also think about the cost of not doing this, because there's a cost to that too. It's a cost of families making decisions about not having kids. It is parents, usually mothers, coming out of the workforce to put in their careers on hold, lowering their, you know, opportunities and income to stay home to take care of kids because they just cannot afford childcare. And it is more than just daycare, as was said. It is early learning, and it is developing brains of little ones. And we know those early years are so, so important. We all recognize kindergarten through, you know, 12th grade as a public good that we make investments in because it, our whole society is better for it. This is the same thing. It's exactly the same thing. And so we, I'm hopeful, can look at that differently and really make a decision as a state that, you know, we are going to invest in this because it matters and because we are all better for it. So thank you for bringing this bill, and I'm really excited to see it move forward.
Thank you, Senator. Anybody else? Thank you, Senator. I want to echo what my colleague said. Thrilled is a good word to use, because we are, and I know that. One of the things that takeaways for me in the last session was this whole notion that the North Star State will be a state that young couples, young individuals, young families, when looking for the state that they want to build their future on and become a member of, will look at Minnesota closely, knowing that we've done the right thing with respect to daycare among the myriad of other things we've been working on in the last year or so on helping young families choose a place to raise their family. And it just adds, and I know Senator McQuaid and I are trying to redefine world's best workforce, but when I think of the whatever phrase we start calling it, the world's best workforce, I think this just fits in so well with that notion, and world's best workforce doesn't begin in kindergarten, it begins at birth. So I just want to thank you. And do you, I forgot to ask you if you want to move this and send it to Education Finance Committee at the beginning?
Yes, that would be great, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All those members, we Senator Hochschild renews or doesn't renew it, but makes it for the first time. Senate File 3790 to be referred to Education Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Hochschild. Next up is Senate File 3924. Senator Bolden. This bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Senator Bolden, when you're ready, we'll explain your bill. And we've got one speaker testifying virtually.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I am grateful to be before you with Senate File 3924. Unlike other states, Minnesota has a variety of special education licensure areas, which makes the reciprocity process difficult to navigate. It is resource intensive, it is complicated, it takes a lot of time. For out-of-state licensed special education teachers who wish to earn licensure here in Minnesota. We know that there is a shortage of special education teachers across Minnesota, and so streamlining this reciprocity process would help to increase the pool of qualified licensed special education teachers. So this bill would direct Pelsby to establish a working group to look at that process of reciprocity for licenses for special education. Membership is listed there, and I would, Mr. Chair, like to make an oral amendment.
Explain the amendment, please, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll tell you the details of it, but I'll just broadly, what I would like to do is where it talks about the membership. Currently, it lists two licensed special ed teachers, one from the metro and one from Greater Minnesota. I want to just double that, so there will be four teachers total, two from the metro and two from Greater Minnesota. So that would be on lines 2.6 and 2.7. On line 2.6, I would change 2 to 4, and 1 to 2. And then on line 2.7, I would change 1 to 2.
Ms. Lewis, could you explain that in a little bit more detail? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, on the bill language before you on page 2, line 6, the delete the word 2, the number, and then insert 4. And again on page 2, line 6, delete 1 and insert 2, it's TWO. Then page 2, line 7, delete 1 and insert 2, TWO.
Thank you. Okay, all those in favor of the oral amendment say aye.
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 All those opposed? Thank you. Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the bill lists membership of this group, and so the group would meet, and then by February 1st of 2025, they would submit recommendations to Pelsby for consideration in their legislative priorities to bring to us as a body with the goal of streamlining this process for reciprocity of special education degrees, as it is a space where we need to make it easier for teachers to come in.
Okay, we have a testifier online. Begin when you're ready and identify yourself, please.
Yes. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tanya Tacker, and I'm the Executive Director of Special Education for the Rum River Special Education Cooperative, proudly serving 6 member school districts, Bram, Isle, Malacca, Mora, Ogilvie, and Princeton. Thank you for all you do on behalf of Minnesota students. I appreciate the time to speak with you today. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Administrators of Special Education, representing over 600 members and testifying in support of Senate File 3924. The out-of-state reciprocity process for special education licensure is complex due to the variety of special education licenses for teachers of special education in Minnesota. making it more difficult for teachers licensed in other states to use reciprocity to obtain a Minnesota license. The importance of Senate File 3924 is to allow special education administrators and educators to work with the Professional Educator Licensing Standards Board, PELSB, to review what changes need to be made in statute or rule to address these barriers. The licensure requirements for special education are also complex. For example, the blind visually impaired license is required in the state, but there are no colleges or universities in Minnesota that actually offer this licensure program. Another example is Minnesota is one of the few states that requires the physical impairment license, while other states do not have this requirement. Three of the top five licensure areas with the largest number of Tier 1, Tier 2, and out-of-field permissions are special education licenses. These licensure areas are academic behavior strategists, emotional behavior disorders, and autism spectrum disorders. While there may be qualified licensed special education teachers from other states with similar license, because the license is not exactly the same or directly comparable, these special education teachers often cannot obtain reciprocity in Minnesota. For example, a teacher from out of state who is licensed to work with special education students ages birth to 9 wanted to work in early elementary special education in Minnesota. This teacher's license was denied as their license in Minnesota could only allow them to work with students ages birth to age 6, limiting her only to early childhood programs. These are just a few examples of the complexity of the special education licenses and the need for this work group. Establishing this work group will allow for a process that engages impacted stakeholders to review statutes and rules that make it more difficult for individuals with special education licenses from another state to qualify for a special education license in Minnesota, which in turn would assist districts with filling vacant positions with licensed special education teachers to be in front of students with disabilities. Thank you once again for the opportunity to share my experience in support of Senate File 3924.
Thank you. We have a couple additional speakers. I'm going to limit you to 2 minutes because you weren't on the original agenda. So thank you, Ms. Snyder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to testify. My name is Caitlin Snyder. I am a lobbyist with Education Minnesota. I'm here today to testify in support of this bill, especially with the addition of the oral amendment that was incorporated earlier to make sure that there are teachers at the table making decisions like this. So I think that there was a really good explanation of the bill by the previous testifier, and the issue in front of PELSB right now is that if you're license in another state is a little bit broader than what you've got in Minnesota, you have to be licensed here in the narrowest part of the scope. So there could be some recommendations that come out of this working group that help address a number of folks that could be teaching appropriately in Minnesota schools. This is part of the conversation about the teacher shortage in special education. Of course, we're excited to be talking about bigger changes in the working conditions for special education teachers as well, but happy to support this.
Thank you. Mr. Heller, do you want to utilize this 2 minute time limit? Okay, begin with your testimony. Thank you.
Hi, everybody on the education policy in the Senate. My name is Rick Heller. Unofficially represent twice the exceptional people with print disabilities. Last year they changed the word handicapped to print disability in the omnibus bill. Also represented in Senate File 2924. I heard the word autism today. I also heard the word blind. And In 2019, Library of Congress Services merged blind and print disability, called them eligible persons. Library specialists need to be in this. It's because of that. Obviously, I'm open to discussions on that, but in 2019, they broadened the certifying authority, including librarians, social workers, case managers, vocational rehabilitation counselors, and more, even superintendents, frankly. But the story of this is, because they're certifying authorities, likely are professionals that are licensed by the state, I suggest that you would include that library piece in there regarding this discussion as it relates to other states and how they're making aware about the new change of blind or handicapped to print disability as well as the certifying authority. Those are the suggestions I'm providing for today. I'm open to any feedback on that. And I would ask that the governor's bill would be handout would be made fully accessible. I spoke to Dosh Uni. He says he won't give me a timeline on accessibility of the handout, the big PowerPoint they had. Also, one other suggestion, because as we can see, the public can see the screens in this room, if I may, that you would put the faces on the, in here like you have out in the hallway. That way I can see the lips moving. That would be helpful with the captioning. Thank you again for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you. Members, any insights, observations? Seeing none, any final remarks, Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and would ask for member support.
Okay, all those in favor of Senate File 3924 being laid over? Okay. No, we'll speed up the process. Next up is Senate File 3369. This will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Senator Gustafson, whenever you're ready. Do you have an amendment for your bill?
Hello, Mr. Chair. Yes, we do have an amendment. If we want to do that first, it will get the bill in the proper order.
Yes, that'd be great.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Abler.
I'll move the amendment from my good colleague.
Great. I'm so moved. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. SF 3369 creates a simple but crucial change to help combat the mental health crisis in our students are facing. It would require that schools provide a secondary students with a private in-school location to access mental health care through telehealth. As a teacher, I've seen firsthand how bad the mental health crisis is for our students. Providing them the space would be vital. Given how terrible Minnesota's counselor-to-student ratio is, SF 3369 is a necessary and practical change to make sure that students are able to access care. Telehealth has been growing in popularity over the past few years, and anecdotal evidence abounds about how helpful it can be in addressing mental health. Any parent or teacher can tell you that our students' packed schedules make scheduling appointments for them difficult, if not impossible. SF 3369 will open up a significant flexibility, allowing our students to access the care they need in a timely and consistent manner. The bill also provides schools the resources they need to implement this policy. It leaves the location and setup of the telehealth space to the school, and the implementation of the policy is dependent on the school having enough space for the accommodation. Schools also have given the ability to request verification that the student is using the space for telehealth. Telehealth is proven to be a transformative tool for adults, and SF 3369 will make sure we are giving this new resource to our students as well. Just a word about the amendment that was just moved. It has been worked on with several of our education allies, including MSBA, MASA, AMSD, and group of principals over the past 3 months with our counterpart, Representative Norris, in the House. So we want to just say thank you to them for getting this in a place place where schools and administration is approved of the amendment and the language that was used. They've worked on this for quite some time over the summer, and we just want to thank them for their work.
And I see you have a testifier.
We do.
Okay. Begin when you're ready.
All right. My name is Brian Reynolds. I wish I had a great title like all the other people. I'm just a parent.
That's the greatest of titles.
It really is. You are correct. Thank you, Senators, for allowing me to be here today. Thank you, Senator Gustafson, for supporting the bill and inviting me here to testify. In 2021, my daughter Brielle was diagnosed with mild anxiety. She had made it through a year of distance learning in our home district due to COVID, like everyone else. Had moved to a public charter with a Montessori style of teaching, left her swim team for a new swim team, and her teachers and coaches had noticed some pretty minor behavioral issues. So we all got together, we made a plan, and we sought out some mental health therapy for her. We are privileged enough to be able to afford those services. I know a lot of people are not. Her school was more than willing at that time to give her space at the school so she could do virtual meetings with her therapist. Everything was very simple to arrange. Basically, they said it was good for Brielle, so it wasn't a problem. She aged out of that Montessori school in 2022, and we made the choice not to return to our home school district of Spring Lake Park. Brielle, to her credit, had researched and learned that the graduation rate was dropping. There were lack of opportunities in academics, and the principal made some pretty distasteful jokes about a student at the school who had died by suicide, and so we did not go back to that school. We looked at a few schools, and thankfully she chose a public school, Centennial High School. She started there last year. After she made that decision, we had all summer to conduct therapy sessions at home, so we didn't really need any help from the school yet. She joined the swim team at Centennial, made new friends, and as the school year started, she was doing everything a parent wants her to do. She was excelling academically, she was swimming varsity events, and her social life was back in order. I reached out to the school counselor to ask about Brielle using a room to take those therapy calls. It was 1 hour every other week from 3 to 4 o'clock. Between the end of the school day and the beginning of practice, no one else was using the rooms at that time. This would make it so she did not have to miss class and take her therapy appointments, and she would not have to miss swim practice, two things that she did not want to do and caused her anxiety to flare up when she just thought about missing those things. I thought this request was a pretty no-brainer request, that it was more of a formality than anything else. I was just asking for an empty room. That was not the case. I was met with a wall of no's from the school counselor, from her guidance counselor, from the principal, from everyone I could find at the district to talk to. They gave me reasons like we don't allow outside therapists on campus. I reminded them that no therapist would be on campus, that it was telehealth. We just needed a room. They asked me who would support her if she were in crisis. The answer, of course, would be her therapist, who she is on the phone with. Then they asked, what if every student requested a room to use for this? And my answer to that was, what a great problem to have, that every student would have access to a mental health professional and all we needed to do was find them space to take a phone call. I was told by the principal that I could always take her out of school to attend the appointments. And he noted, as a parent, you have the right to take your child out of school whenever you want for any reason. I didn't really need to be reminded of my rights as a father, but it was nice. Then it became a chorus of, it's against policy. When I asked which policy, no one could answer. It was just, quote, policy. I made it clear I was requesting a reasonable mental health accommodation. The answer was still no. I called the Minnesota Department of Education, who told me I had a likely 504 complaint with the federal government, but that the DOE here in the state does not have authority over those protections. They helped me find the resources I needed to file that complaint. The first step was to file with the district. At this point, I hope you can all guess how that went. More stonewalling. The principal was listed as the contact just to get the form. I requested it from him. He then accidentally copied me on an email intended for someone else asking if I had the right to request this form. when there was no formal 504 plan in place for my daughter. I had questions then. He refused to answer all of them, so there was no word on whether or not a parent had the right just to request the form, regardless of complaint, nor if the question of the plan being needed should be determined after a complaint was filed. No word on if the form was a secret form and could only be obtained by certain people. I got the form from someone else in a different district. Turns out it's the same form for every school, and found the contact to file the complaint, so I did. There was no response for the person listed as the contact at the district as both the 504 and Title IX contact. Instead, I was forwarded to, quote, the executive director of teaching and learning for the district, who told me there was no 504 rights violation. He had not spoken to me. He had not spoken to my daughter. He had determined with no investigation that there was no violation. The district had investigated itself and found no violations. On advice of my neighbor, I contacted an attorney who told me to file a complaint with the federal government. I did. Again, months went by. No contact other than an acknowledgement of the receipt of the complaint. I reached out to the person listed on the email, and she got back to me and said, whoops, we had your email wrong. Sorry, can we set up a call? So we did. She called. She asked me three or four questions, very basic in nature, my daughter's name, what school she attends, things like that. She hung up, she said, thank you, you'll get a letter with our determination. The letter came a couple of weeks later and said there are no violations of 504 rights. Again, I don't know what investigation was done. The irony was not lost on me that I was already at the federal government level to request an empty room to take a phone call in. Our lawyer at the time disagreed. She recommended, of course, a lawsuit, which would cost me money, cost the district money, probably solve nothing. All the while, my daughter would be missing appointments, missing school, or missing practice. In the meantime, I found another backdoor at the district, a person willing to give us a room, no questions asked, and of course, I took them up on the offer. Having secured the room, I told our lawyer we were not interested in a prolonged legal battle. I felt I had accomplished the mission at hand. My daughter had the room she needed. She could do her therapy, and all was right and good again. When I picked her up at practice that night, I told her the good news. I don't think I expected a parade and, oh my God, Dad, I love you so much post on her TikTok account. She is a teenager, after all. But her response was muted. She looked me directly in the eye and said, I appreciate what you did, but what happens to the next kid? The kid who doesn't have you. The kid that has parents who don't know how to do what you did or just don't have the time and energy to do it. Who fights for them? I paused. I was taken aback by the fact that my then 14-year-old daughter was rightfully putting me in my place. Then she said the thing that leads us to be here today. Dad, you solved our problem. You did not solve the problem. So I contacted Representative Norris on the House side and told him the story you just heard. We had many discussions, met with many stakeholders, and the overwhelming response has been, every time I tell this story, is, I don't understand why she couldn't just use a room. Seems like a no-brainer. In a world where our young people are struggling with mental health issues, where we as adults, as parents, as elected officials have said numerous times, we need to do something, this is something we can do. The best I can tell, this costs $0. We don't need to build any new buildings. We don't need a new agency. We don't need to raise taxes. We just need to tell the schools to let the kids use the rooms that already exist so they can take a phone call. Again, it still seems like an absolute no-brainer. Thank you for your time and your commitment to serving the people of Minnesota.
Okay, members, any questions or comments? Oh, do you want to explain the amendment?
Sure, Mr. Chair. The amendment is just a couple of things. It allows, it kind of clears up and clarifies a little bit more of access to space, what space is. They sort of define what that space might look like, and then also provides a little bit of an immunity. If you want to go down to subsection 2, it'll tell you a little bit more about the immunity and that a school, district, or charter school is immune from liability for any tort claim based on an act or omission of an officer, unless the claim is based on recklessness, gross negligence, or intentional misconduct. So it just provides a little bit of comfort language for school districts.
Members?
Yeah.
Senator Abler.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You know, so I'm happy to support the amendment, and I'm happy that you worked with the schools. I have no idea why common sense cannot prevail. A lot of us here live in a world where we have to maintain a business and deal with people, and you just think that some of those same common sense people are running around, and then every so often, I have no idea what was in someone's mind that deprived your daughter of this, or who knows how many other kids, and then we have to pass a law, like really? And so, and I'm glad you're here, and you know, good for your daughter caring about somebody else. And I mean, just my comments are all obvious, but it's.
Yes.
You know, I've been here a while, and it just, and people think, you got to pass a law for this? Well, apparently so. Mm-hmm. And so you're on doing a good thing. So just thanks, Senator, and to you, sir. I didn't hear your name, but God bless you. And say hi to your daughter for us. Tell her that we're happy to support someone else, too.
Thank you. Your daughter sounds like she's mature beyond her years. Yeah. So nice job on the role that you played in raising somebody with that amount of empathy for her species, especially at that age. We're dealing with chronic absenteeism right now, and any attempt whatsoever to make it easier for families to not miss a half day of school or a half day of practice. And if that's what can come out of this bill is making the appropriate accommodations between after school and practice, so the family isn't has to go pick up their daughter or son and miss school and miss practice and everything that entails, mission accomplished. So thank you for bringing this bill forward, Senator Gustafson. And so, do you have any final comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to quickly say thank you to Senator Bolden, who's joined me on this bill. And just to echo what Senator Abler was saying, this is a no-cost, common-sense bill. It won't cost us anything. It's not this policy that's going to take extra staff to implement. It's just freeing up a room. I'm a former teacher at Centennial High School. I know that there are available rooms. Your daughter would have been welcome to use mine. I think this is one of those things that, like Senator Abler said, it's unfortunate that we would even need to get involved at this step, but I'm happy that we're doing it. And I just wanted to also thank my testifier, thinking a little bit about what his daughter said. You showing up today is a really good example of how you are here to fight for all the other students in Minnesota. So thankful for her, thankful for you, and thank you to the committee for hearing this bill.
So Senate file 3369 is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you. Senator Kunesh and Senate file 4105. And when you get settled, Senator, if you'd move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move Senate File 4105.
So moved.
Members, this bill is a bill that has been around for a while, maybe 13 years. Some people think of 13 as maybe not a lucky number, but perhaps this is the lucky number for the impetus behind this bill, Larry Leno, and the work that he has been doing on this. Not long ago, it was common practice to use unlined landfills, which allowed chemicals to leach into our soil and groundwater. And those consequences are the consequences, the health consequences that we're dealing with today in different parts of Minnesota. The research has shown the risks of these landfills pose to kids' lungs, brain development, and future health, whether through contaminated soil, off-gassing chemicals, or tainted water. When our teachers send kids out for recess, we want parents to know that they're not risking a future health problem just by playing out in the open air and in the fields. This bill will prohibit the construction of new schools within a quarter mile of a dump site or closed landfill. Any schools that already exist within that limit would be able to test or would have to test for possible contaminants on or near its grounds and share the results with the family. With that information in hand, families are then empowered to, and communities are empowered to ensure that those schools and the education that the students are being provided are free of risks that this kind of contamination would possess. So we know that our children are our future. They're the future of Minnesota. So let's make sure that we are doing the best we can to protect them from the environmental hazards like landfills from decades ago. So what this bill will do, as I said, requires or will prohibit the construction of new schools within a quarter of a mile, but also ask the require the schools to get a report on possible pollutants and share the results with the families and with the staff. There are some exclusions if the project from the soil gas has been sampled and tested by an independent contractor using those industry protocols for methane and all volatile organic chemicals on the PCA's heavy metal list. That can be bypassed if they have a written document with a determination by the PCA that confirms that the soil testing and the methods were properly conducted. So it doesn't mean that it would have to happen every single year to every single school. And so with that, Mr. Chair, we have two folks that would like to testify, Larry Leno and Wayne Saparo.
Come on up.
Sarapo, excuse me. Come on up, guys.
And identify yourself for the record. Make sure you sign in on the clipboard and begin when you're ready.
Okay. Thank you, Chair, for allowing us to speak here today. My name is Larry Leno. Many of you I've seen and spoke while you were in the House before you got to the Senate. I've been here for a while, and I plan on coming back if we have to. And I'd like to give the legislators who in the past have signed on to this bill and taken the time to listen to the explanation why this bill is necessary. I hope that you all received a folder and had an opportunity to look at it that you received today. I want to tell that I first got involved with the need for this legislation after I received a phone call from my daughter informing me that my grandson had a compromised immune system and that his condition may be terminal. I can assure you that when it's your family member, you will not feel like it's a statistic nor a coincidence. It is what still drives my passion to get this bill passed today. Since this bill has been introduced 12 years ago, I have undergone both surgery, radiation, and chemical intervention to prevent a cancer. Rest assured, the most cost-effective method to prevent and cure cancer is early prevention to cancerous environments whenever possible. Awareness of the hidden dangers once determined that a human risk exists, and the opportunity for detection that comes with the knowledge of one's surroundings. As a former elected official, I realize that all elected officials. Our sworn duty is to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the public. Current Minnesota regulations prohibit toxic landfills from being permitted next to a school. Now it's time to pass legislation that prevents schools from being built near a toxic dump site. All government agencies involved in permitting relating to schools must include toxic level reporting requirements during the permitting process to ensure accountability and awareness. Those are phase one and phase two studies. It's required for any public school in excess of $500,000. So the cost borne has already been borne by the school district when requiring a permitting process. Currently, the standards used for school districts use the industrial scale, which is 10 times the residential scale for acceptable levels of toxins. Your child should be as safe at school as they are at home. It's a parent's right to know about potential risks associated with schools sited on landfills that exceed residential standards. So one of the things I'd like to inform you is that children's bodies are more sensitive than adults. Children are less able to handle toxic chemical exposures. They breathe more air and eat more per pound than adults do. And one of the things that exercise and precaution in the siting of schools will prevent is future financial loss in terms of decreased students' IQs, increases in injuries and illness among children and employees, and increased potential for lawsuits costing facilities much-needed education dollars. There is no government agency that will accept liability for setting a school near a toxic site that exceeds residential levels. In fact, public school insurance policies, if you read them, exclude liability from pollution. This bill, if passed, will only affect schools exceeding residential levels of toxins established by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Health to protect the health, safety, and welfare of children and staff. Aaron Brockovich said it best. You may live on top of or attend a school located on a top of a Superfund site being exposed to chemicals without your knowledge. This exposure may not show the disease process for 20 years, but nobody's coming back and monitoring you. So let's start working in a bipartisan fashion, start working together and find out what's happening in our community. We expect our children to clean up their bedrooms. I think it's time we expect of ourselves to clean up our mess and begin to take a look at what we have done and what may be happening with the people. At this time, I would encourage this body to pass a bill onto the next committee so that this bill can be passed in a timely fashion. And hopefully you can retire me. I'll go back to shoveling manure at home at the farm where I belong. Thank you.
Next testifier.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you for allowing me to testify in favor of Senate File 4105. My name is Wayne Serapo. I've been retired from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency for 7 years now. And while I worked at the MPCA, I worked in the state and federal Superfund programs and the Voluntary Investigation Cleanup Program. I'm here to support Senate File 4105. One of the many reasons I support this bipartisan, well-written bill is because of my many years working to clean up the contaminated soil and waters of the state. As you know, it is extremely difficult, time-consuming, and expensive to remove contaminants from the groundwater. I believe that this bill provides strong legislation which will help prevent future contamination of our groundwater, surface water, and soil. Most importantly, however, it provides for the safety of our school-aged children while also ensuring that the parents and/or guardians of their school-aged children will be notified of any sources of contamination on or near the school. The bill will also provide protection for the teachers, administrators, and other workers at the school. I would like to use an example from my own city of Grant, which I think will be illustrative of what happens in the absence of this bill. This information has been provided by former state senator, former state representative, Barbara Hockey, who also served as a board member of the Minnesota Association of Watershed Districts, as well as a board member of the Rice Creek Watershed District. Her letter is included in your information packet and is summarized as follows. Ms. Hockey stated that as a former RCWD member, Rice Creek Watershed District member, she sat on the board as the committee approved permits that she felt placed our children at risk over her expressed objections. The RCWD approved of the placement of water and sewer lines which passed through contaminated soils on the former Bellers sanitation dump site, which is now the location of the Wildwood Elementary School. It is strongly suspected that these utility lines provided a conduit for contamination from the dump site to flow into Lost Lake, thereby resulting in Lost Lake being placed on the list of impaired waters of the state. It is Ms. Hockey's contention that this approval was granted because she thinks that too often agencies such as the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, the Minnesota DNR, the Department of Natural Resources, the Minnesota Department of Health, plus watershed districts only review and approve areas within proposed projects that are clearly under their respective jurisdictions and therefore without consulting other agencies. Had the RCWD, for example, consulted with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency on this issue, steps could have been taken to prevent the potential transport of contamination into the lake. Therefore, we believe that this bill, when passed, will prevent such problems from occurring because all state, county, and local government officials, along with environmental consultants and concerned citizens, will know of its passage and will adhere to its provisions. Thank you.
Thank you, both testifiers. Questions, comments from committee? Senator Makeway.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, I'm having one of those moments where you're like, what? So just to this packet that we have here, it looks like there was a bill that was introduced in 2011 to not have schools built on toxic dump sites. There was a bill, there was a school built on a toxic dump site, even after the citizens wrote a letter on April 18th, 2011, expressing concerns. And then now we have students who matriculated from that elementary school having cancer in high school, so many that they're having cancer fundraisers to support the three students in the district that have had cancer at a young age. So what? Like, this is wild. Are there other elementary schools, middle schools, high schools that are built on toxic dump sites? I saw in this packet that California is number one and then Minnesota is number two. Can you just say more about that?
Yes, yes, ma'am. I used the basis that's called people investigating toxic school sites. So California is the worst violator in the country. Minnesota is number two. Minnesota had basically 11 sites that were identified when they built Wildwood Elementary. And you can see in that letter I wrote back in 2011, prior to building the school, to prevent this, it made Minnesota the Dirty Dozen, or Matamita School District. My concern is, in fact, some of you may have served with Senator Greg Claussen. I remember when he first, I spoke to him, he says, Larry, am I in trouble? Am I okay? I said, Mr. Claussen, would you like to look at the list I have? And he did, he opened up it. He says, Sunnyside Elementary, my goodness, he says, my aunt worked in the office there. She died early in her 40s of cancer, along with four other office staff that were young, and they always suspected something was on in the building, but never, it's hard to associate where you know, get your illness from. Personally, my own involvement was probably because I overate candy on my off time during the winter when I worked in a shop and had access to three bags of candy, and I probably OD'd on it. you know, for a period of time, my body could only handle it up to a certain point. But I mean, it's hard to recognize where you get it. But this bill will, once it's been recognized and identify the toxins, because you can see there's a lot of those toxins that exceeded residential levels that would prohibit building a house on there. Mm. But it didn't reach 10 times that level, you know, which is what industrial standards are. And your schools are not considered the residential acceptable levels. They're industrial. So this will prevent it. You'll see that the students that are showing up now is exactly why I got Erin Brockovich involved early on. And she said, well, the state doesn't want to listen to us now before the school is being built. They will have to listen to us later as they start showing up. I can give you a video where she talks about the 30 girls that were all to go to a 20-year class reunion. Mm. They said they couldn't show up, some of them here, and they're explaining why. Well, I've got brain cancer. And the other one said, well, I got brain cancer. Well, turned out 30 of those women all had a form of brain cancer. Mm-hmm. Didn't show up till you're about 15 to 18. So the only common denominator is the school was built next to a toxic site. And as you can see through the pictures I provided, this had a Superfund number on it. It was simply stated it was cleaned up. They put 2 foot of clay on top. But once they built that school and ran their sewer and water lines against plumbing codes, which I have copies of, it was turned down 4 times. And yet, between the school board and the city council, they got it pushed through. This bill would prevent that. It would save the lake, because remember, when you run sewer lines, it's all down gradient. You open up that and allow that plume to travel. There's a reason we put seals on dumps and we don't interfere with them. So, yes, ma'am, it's happened. It's not real bad here. And the last page I showed you, that the Met Council has funding available for grants to clean up sites. And like I said, if you're one of the few who has a child that has a compromised immune system, you have the right to know. And they can simply, notification be as simple as the city newsletter they send out 4 times, you know, to every school district. Or you can simply choose the parents in that one school that's next to it that's toxic. So I think it's time we move this forward. And like I said, it's a great bipartisan bill you can all be proud of when you go caucus tomorrow night.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that, yes, I appreciate that. Well, Senator Kunesh, I think this is a great bill. I'm sad that it's here now. Senator Klassen was my predecessor. I wish it would have been passed when he was in office. So I'm horrified and also urgent. Thank you.
Senator Abler.
Well, thanks. I guess we have a couple bills that we think should never happen. Why would they do that? And when I was reading, I have to admit, Senator Kunesh, Mr. Lanou, have we met? You seem familiar to me in the name, and I've been around a while, so maybe
our paths have crossed. Senator Abler, I believe you co-authored on this bill.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
I believe I talked to you when you were in the House. And I will remind you of a former colleague, Representative Carlos Mariani. First time I brought him, he says, Larry, stick with it. He says, some of my best legislation, he says, has taken me the longest to get passed. I think this might be one of those bills.
Thank you, and Mr. Chair, I just don't know how. Well, just back up. So Andover, that I represent, has a dump site, and we had to pay quite a bit of money to get that stuff out of there. It showed up in people's water, an array of chemicals, lately 1,4-dioxane. Some people are 2 years on bottled water from actually these kind of unknown sites where they even come from, but it seems where they, and so part of it was known, part of it's been kind of a surprise, and Andover used to have big piles of tires and back in the day, and it's a whole different town now than it was 40 years ago. So I don't know, Senator Cooney, if you don't mind, maybe I'll co-author again. It seems that just, so I mean, you've said your case, and I'm just shocked with what I was reading about you know, that people are ignoring this. It just does not make sense to ignore it and using the science. I for one, have thought it made a lot of sense to incorporate all the water review in Minnesota in one agency so they can all talk to each other, because you got the PCA, you got the soil water, you got the county, you got cities, and so there's, they just don't all talk, and sometimes they get conflicting information about what's allowed or what's not. But at least in this case, they would have said, by the way, you don't want to really do that. So Senator Kunesh, as the bill moves forward, I just have a suggestion. Mr. Lanoue mentioned something, but just to kind of streamline the reporting thing, you might, I'm sure the districts would have a thought about that. I don't think we should let them off the hook, though. I think that this needs to go forward now, and I think with noticing that, then I think you'll find them to be, I don't think they want to hurt people either, so let's just help them keep them from that. So thank you.
Anybody else? Well, we can't help where our ancestors decided to build their landfills. And during much of your testimony, I had visions of myself growing up. We'd go swimming in Lake Superior, and right behind us was this mountainous landfill that the bears would climb to the top of, and we'd throw apples at them or whatever we did as kids. But to think that they built this landfill right on the shores of Lake Superior is just so egregious to us today. But at the time, you know, it was cheap land, and that's where they decided to put it. But what we can do today is prevent what is put on those old landfills. And so I just want to thank you, Senator Kunesh, for bringing this forward, and do the right thing and try to keep those kids safe. And so thanks. 13 years. It's a long time to be working on a bill.
Yes, sir. So. I'm not a lobbyist. I pay for my own gas and parking to come down here and speak to you, and it's a good investment.
Well, we hope to put you out of business, so you can go back to shoveling manure. We're all envious of what you get to do.
I got 40 head of horses at home, and I tell you what, I enjoy it.
Thank you. Senator Kunesh, any final comments?
No, thank you for hearing this, and thank you for those that are voicing your support. And I'd be happy to have you sign on, Senator Abler.
Okay, Senate file. Thank you. 4105 is going to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. So thank you, Senator Kunesh.
Thank you. All
right. With that said, another quick reminder about Wednesday. Hopefully we can take Wednesday's schedule and fill it in our available time slots that are being depleted rather rapidly. But nonetheless, we're going to see everybody on Monday, next a week from today. Thanks for being here today.